hot. And so I know friends here in LA, and so we're lowering the temperature for you about 12 degrees from yesterday. So you should find it a little bit cooler than it was yesterday. Zane, we're grateful to have you here, and we hope you'll enjoy the rest of the day. It's going to be a very long but very special day. Don't forget, we don't end until late tonight on Friday, so I hope you're just drinking a lot of coffee so you don't need to take an afternoon nap and miss all the wonderful things we have to offer today. Zane, is this your first time on our program?
It is.
Yeah. It is. Well, I hope it's not the last time. We're glad to have you here. God bless you, and take it away.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I thought I would start very briefly. I've already introduced myself to some of you personally, but give a brief history of myself and my background to kind of help inform our discussion today in the class. Since 2008, I have been serving as a missionary and a church planter in the city of Niterói in Brazil. That's directly across the bay from Rio de Janeiro. I'd like to say that if there wasn't a bay between Rio and Niterói, Niterói would just be a suburb, another suburb of Rio. We would be swallowed up by it. Niterói has about 500,000 residents. In the surrounding area, it has about 1.5 million people. And my wife and I, along with a team of five families, left in 2008 to go plant a church there, a new church plant in the city. And without giving you a full missions report, since that's not our purpose today, I'll just say that the work is going very well there. We've been blessed to hire a Brazilian to come and work with us recently in the past year. And with changes in the team, we've also just added two new teammates, two new families in the past 2 months. So the team is growing, the church is growing. We recently celebrated our fourth anniversary of the church there in Niterói, and we also closed a purchase of the land, which we hope to begin construction for a permanent location for the church in the next several months. So the church is doing well. The future for the church appears secure and bright, and so we're excited about that. If you would like any more information about the work, about the team, you can visit the team's website. It's niteroimission.com, all together. And we'll have plenty of information up there if you'd like to know more about the work. As for myself and my family, we left in 2008 to go to Brazil, and we gained, or as they like to say in Portuguese, we won two additional family members to our team, or to our family while we were there. And so we now have two sons, two young Brazilians, since they were both born there in Brazil. They're both fixing to turn, one is fixing to turn three, and our youngest is fixing to turn one. So they're a handful. They keep us busy all the time. And my wife and I and our family just returned from the mission field about a month ago, and we relocated back to the U.S. after our commitment there. And so I'll be beginning a master's at Emory in the fall in Atlanta, so we'll be moving there. And until then, as somebody said, we're just living out of a minivan until that time. So we're going around to family, friends, staying on people's couches, sleeping wherever we can. So now that you know about me, let's talk about our class this morning. Very briefly, just to give you a short introduction, we're going to be talking about Brazil, the nation of Brazil, but more importantly, or in a greater scale, we're going to be talking about the rise of the Global South, specifically the rise of Christianity within the Global South. I'll confess in the beginning that because of my personal background and my personal bias, a lot of my stories, a lot of my accounts of seeing growth will come from Brazil or South America. But keep in mind that what I express of Brazil or South America is just a small example of what's happening throughout Asia and throughout Africa. And in fact, in some ways, it's better represented in Asia and Africa with the explosive growth that those two areas are seeing. So keep that in mind. I would share more examples from Africa and Asia, but as I said, my background, my history is in Brazil and South America, and so those stories come most readily to mind. To give you a quick 30-second summary of our class today, Christianity is experiencing expansive and massive growth in the South. The Global South is a term which we'll define briefly here in a minute, but in these regions which Christianity has tended to have little foothold in the past, it is now experiencing impressive growth. And so today we are going to look at some of the growth patterns, we're going to look at some of the statistics, and to close we're going to look at some of the possible implications for the future of the global church. But before we get into those implications, I'm going to have to unfortunately pound you over the head with some statistics to make sure that we're all on the same page and we all understand this growth. So if you're not a numbers person, bear with us through the first 15 minutes, and after that we'll get into talking about something more substantive. Now, I was wanting to give a homework assignment before we began class, but I decided that that probably wasn't fair. So instead of giving you homework and making you Google for answers to these two surveys, I would like for us just to take some wild guesses, and then we'll look at the actual statistics. But what I have here is a top 10 list, two top 10 lists, one from the year 1900, another top 10 list from the year 2010. The countries that are listed here are the top 10 Christian nations by population size, by the number of Christians living within those nations. So it's not percentage-based, it's holy number-based. But these are the top 10 Christian nations in the world based on the number of Christians living within that country. So would anybody care to wager any guesses at the top three Christian nations in the year 1900? I'll give you a hint. The first one should be fairly easy for you to guess.
U.S.?
Yes, the United States. In 1900, the United States was the largest Christian nation in the world, followed by Russia as number three. The third largest Christian nation was Germany, and then you can see the others there. And the only other country that, I won't say the only other country that's noteworthy, but the only other country that I'm going to draw attention to is Brazil at number 10. Now, the reason I draw attention to Brazil at number 10 is not only because of my personal bias and my love for the country of Brazil, but does anybody care to wager a guess as to why Brazil is significant on this list of top 10 nations?
Because it's the only one that's still on this list in 2010.
Okay, good. That's close. That's close.
It's in South America and everything else is Europe.
Yes, yes. Brazil is the only country that appeared on the top 10 Christian nations in 1900 that was not found in Europe or North America. And so Brazil would be, in 1900s, the only country which is classified as the Global South. So, real quick, to take a moment to define the Global South. The Global South is not, as you would suspect, a geographical term, but it is more of a socioeconomic term. So don't get caught up thinking strictly in terms of geography or northern and southern hemispheres, because it takes into account a much broader spectrum of factors. In the broadest possible sense, the Global North is usually designated as North America, Europe, and Australia, and the Global South is designated as every other country in the rest of the world. This is based loosely the terms North and South are used because, with the exception of Australia, all of the countries which list highly on the UN's Human Development Index are located in the Northern Hemisphere, while the countries which are rank low on the Human Development Index are located in the Global South, as I mentioned, with the exception of Australia and also Japan. So with that in mind, looking at our top 10 nations, from 1900, you see that Brazil is the only country which qualifies as a Global South country. So let's fast forward to 2010. That's the most recent numbers that I could find. Anyone care to guess the top number one Christian nation in the world today? It's also easy.
USA.
The USA. The United States still remains, by numbers, by sheer numbers, the largest Christian nation in the world. Anybody care to guess number two? I'll tell you that it's my personal favorite.
Brazil.
Brazil has moved from number 10 of the top Christian nations in the year 1900 to, in 2010, Brazil is now the second largest Christian nation in the world. Number three, I won't make you guess it. Number three is Mexico, which didn't even appear on the list in the 1900s. Number four is significant because it's Russia, and Russia has fallen from the second largest Christian nation to now the fourth largest Christian nation. The other countries listed here are significant, as we've talked about, because all of them, if you notice, every single one appears in the Global South. And number nine is significant because Germany has fallen from the third largest Christian nation in the world to now being the ninth largest Christian nation in the world. So as we look at those two numbers.
Question, did it fall or did these other countries surpass?
Both. Let me give you a couple hard numbers so you can see an idea of the growth here. In the year 1900, the U.S. had 73 million Christians. Russia had 62 million Christians, and Germany had 42 million Christians. Today, the United States still remains number one. It has 73 million Christians. Today it has 246 million Christians. So it has basically tripled its Christian population in the past 100 years. Brazil started with 17 million in 1900, and today it has 175 million people. So while the U.S. tripled its growth, I had to actually look this word up, Brazil decupled its growth. That means 10 times. Brazil grew 10 times in that same period. So some of it has to do not necessarily with decline in numbers, but it has to do with the expansive growth of those countries in the south.
What's the population of Brazil now?
Oh, I can't tell you off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
Number four, Russia has 105 million Christians today, and Germany has 58 million Christians. So technically, while Germany didn't decline during that period, I believe it had 43 million Christians in 1900. Today it has 58 million Christians. So it grew by about 15 million Christians, which isn't an impressive growth during that time compared to some of the other numbers that we've seen. Other countries of note. I wanted to draw attention to China because I found two differing reports, and so it depends on which one you go with. I stuck with the same report that I used for the 1900s, but according to the Center for the Study of Global Christianity, they estimate the Chinese population of Christians at 110 million, and that would place China as the number third Christian nation above Mexico if we went with those numbers. The other things that's significant about these countries, as we talked about, none of them appeared. A majority of them didn't appear on the list in 1900. In fact, a majority of these countries didn't even appear in the top 20 in the year 1900. China, for example, in the year 1900 experienced what is called the Boxer Uprising. It was a period in China when more than 250 foreign missionaries, their families, their children were executed, and over 30,000 Chinese Christians were also killed in the Boxer Uprising. And so that happened in China in 1900, so you can see the hostility towards Christianity in that time. And then today, China now has 111 million Christians and can be considered either the third or the seventh largest Christian nation in the world. So as we look at this list of the top 10 nations, what's significant about them is not only that they are now a majority of southern countries, but it's also significant to look at the disbursement of these countries on the 2010 list. No one area, no one geographical area in the South is spurring the strong growth of Christianity, but it is in fact happening almost simultaneously, concurrently throughout all of these various regions. I'd like to share a quick quote with you that I pulled from a Pew Research article where I got most of those top 10 lists. This article stated, "Christians are also geographically widespread, so far flung in fact that no single continent nor region can indisputably claim to be the center of global Christianity. A century ago, this was not the case. In 1910, about two-thirds of the world's Christians lived in Europe, where the bulk of Christians had been for over a millennium. Today, only about a quarter of all Christians live in Europe." Now, if you're still with me after talking about all of those numbers, talking about all of those statistics, let's talk about a little bit, a couple other numbers. I'm going to throw a couple more at you, and then we're going to move on to an actual discussion of these numbers. I'm going to try to share all of these statistics with you as long as the source material is at the bottom of the screen if you would like to check out any of the sources for them. In more recent history, since we were looking at numbers from the 1900s, looking at numbers from the 1970s, briefly to talk about Christianity in North America. In North America in 1970, 91% of North Americans claimed some sort of Christian affiliation. 91% is an incredibly high percentage, but it's predicted that by the year 2020, which is only 6 years away, that number will have fallen to 76%. So that's a decline of 15% in 50 years for North American Christianity. So to answer the previous question about whether it was a decline, or a growth in other countries, while numerically the Christian population in America is larger today than it was in the year 1900, percentage-wise, it's decreasing, and it appears to be predicted to continue to decrease. To give you an idea of growth in other regions in Asia, during this same time frame from 1970 to 2020, it is predicted that the Asian Christian population and the percentage of population will grow by over 100%. Looking at a couple denominational trends of some information I was able to collect, the Anglican Church announced recently in the year 2000 that the number of Anglican members living in Africa now outnumbered the number of Anglican members living in all of Europe. which is where their denomination began. So that's a significant shift for their specific denomination to see that now they host more members in Africa than they do in the founding region for their country. In 1900, more than two-thirds of all Christians lived in either the United States or Europe. Today, more than two-thirds of Christians live in Asia, Africa, or Latin America. That means that now Christians in the global south outnumber their northern counterparts by nearly 2-1. And that also means that geographically and numerically speaking, the center of global Christianity has shifted from the United States and Europe and now rests firmly in the southern hemisphere. Northern Christians are now considered the minority in the total global Christian population. This kind of struck me. I was telling my wife that as I've sat with this class kind of in the back of my mind throughout the lectureships, there's been several comments I've heard that have just drawn attention to the ideas that we're going to discuss today. And so I'll share really briefly yesterday morning, if any of you participated in Jeff Walling's class, he made an offhand comment about somebody approaching him after his class talking about the decline of Christianity in a postmodern world, and that he said that somebody approached him and just expressed concern and maybe even a little despair that Christianity was declining and what we were going to do about it. And he commented that that they shouldn't despair because although Christianity is declining, God will always provide for his church. Mm-hmm. And I thought that his comment and the question needed a little clarifier, mm-hmm. that we aren't talking about the decline of Christianity, but we're talking about the decline of North American Christianity and Northern Christianity. Because as we've seen, Christianity in the global south is experiencing huge growth. So while many of us see, as we look around at churches closing, as we look at neighborhoods where churches are abandoning them and moving to different neighborhoods, as we see that in our own communities, it's important for us to keep in mind that God does not only work in North America, God is working throughout the globe, and that in many regions of the world, Christianity is thriving and growing in a great way. One last statistic for you before we move on this morning, but this just illustrates that this trend that has occurred over the past century is not a trend that's on the verge of leveling out. It's not a trend that's about to end. Of the total population dividing the world into the global north and the global south, Christians in the global north make up nearly 70% of the population. So that means North America and Europe combined, 70% of people claim some sort of Christianity. In the global south, which already outnumbers the global north by more than 2-1, the total percentage of the population which is Christian is only 25%, which leaves huge margins for growth in these southern nations, while in the United States and in North America and in Europe, we see that the church appears to be steadily, statistically speaking, in decline. So here's the most important part, the most important point for us this morning. The face of global Christianity is changing rapidly and dramatically, and sadly, many of us here in the North do not see it. The majority of Christianity is now located in the South, and with that, there are sure to come changes to the global face of Christianity. Andrew Walls, who has dedicated much of his study, his academic study and research to the growth of global Christianity, said this about the history of Christianity. He says, "Christian expansion has been serial. It has not maintained a single cultural or geographical center. It has always retained a substantially separate identity. It recedes as well as advances. It declines or dies out in areas of its greatest strength, and it reappears, often transformed in totally different areas of quite distinct culture. Christian history is a series of cross-cultural movements which result in a succession of different Christian heartlands as the geographical and cultural center of Christianity has changed." It has been the history of Christianity to be multicentric, moving through countries, cultures, and geographical areas without restraint. That is, in fact, one of the distinguishing features of Christianity as a religion, that it isn't bound to any particular land, to any particular culture, and as such, what we are seeing today, while it is dramatic and maybe even a bit frightening or discomforting to some of us, is in reality a continuation of the history of Christianity. So let's turn our discussion to examining a few of the reasons behind this massive growth. While the exact causes for the growth of Christianity in the global south are no doubt myriad and specific to each region and culture, there are several general explanations that we can discuss that tend to affect Christianity in all of these cultures. So I'm going to quickly address three key dynamics which are fueling the growth of Christianity in these areas, and starting with the first, and what I consider probably the most human reason, is that the Bible speaks to the lives and to the struggles of people in the global south. The Bible speaks to the life experiences of people in the global south, and the truth is that the Bible was written, a majority of the Bible was written to an oppressed people living under a foreign or hostile rule, working for little or no wages, and living in relative poverty. While Northerners have tended to extract the moral and ethical teachings of the Bible and put aside the cultural settings, cultural and social settings for many in the global south, the culture and social context of these stories and teachings of Scripture speak as loudly to them as the actual teachings of Scripture themselves. They don't see in Scripture simple stories designed to relate a spiritual message, but they see real-life examples, actual historical stories, relating details of people who share similar life experiences to themselves. People who have the same difficulties, experience the same struggles, and overcome the same obstacles. Caring for the sick, malnourished loved ones, living in exile, separated from family and land, facing disease, famine, food shortages, and sickness, and working for little or no income, and struggling under an oppressive or a controlling leader. All of these factors are still very real and very present in the lives of many in the global south. And the similarities between their lives and those in the Bible are very real. These factors make the Bible and the messages in the Bible very tangible, and the lessons not only morally relevant, but directly applicable to their everyday struggles. Lessons on freedom and liberation do not only apply to their spiritual salvation or to their sin or overcoming weakness, but it extends to their everyday lives. It is a promise and a hope of a better tomorrow, or at least the strength that they can overcome their current obstacle. This makes the message of Christianity a message of hope, and it is a message of hope that is easily shared with others who are equally oppressed and equally depressed. Whispered as a word of encouragement to a fellow laborer in the street or in a crowded factory, a song that is sung to a weak or a hungry child, a comforting word given to a saddened neighbor separated from her family to earn wages to send back while others care for her children. This is how Christianity spreads like wildfire in the global south. Not as a shouted message taught in grand cathedrals or amphitheaters, but as a whisper or a song given to supply hope to those who are suffering. And this is what is spurring the growth of Christianity in the global south. The second reason for Christianity growing so quickly in the south is because it is not only relevant to the everyday lives of the people, but their own cultures share many similarities to the biblical culture, and this again makes the lessons and teachings of Scripture even more tangible to them. Some in the global south live in very close proximity to the geographical landscape presented in the Bible. The setting of the Sermon on the Mount makes sense as they look around and they can easily picture a crowd gathered at the foot of a gentle hillside where the many sea and water-related stories of Scriptures, the deserts, and the ancient cities. Through their daily lives, many in the global south encounter reminders of Scripture, whether it be in eating their daily bread or walking through fields of grain. Whether we acknowledge it or not, our surroundings tend to have a great impact on our lives and how we view things. Those who are geographically close to the very lands where many biblical accounts take place, this only serves to enhance the effectiveness of the stories and the lessons taught for them. And although others are geographically removed from Scripture, their cultures, in fact, still bear many similarities and values of the ancient world. While your gut reaction may be to ask, what possible similarities does an ancient Middle Eastern religious culture share with modern-day Latin American cultures or those living in rural, remote villages in China? While it is no doubt true that no two cultures are exactly the same, similarities that may only appear surface level to us, in fact, serve to enhance the experience of reading and interpreting the Bible for many in the South. Latin American cultures tend to emphasize community. They give great emphasis to communal living, giving high priority to family, friends, and relationships. In many of these cultures, personal relationships take priority over any other social obligation, and it serves as a daily reminder to them of the commandment to love one another, because, of course, love is the greatest commandment we are given. Many Asian cultures place great importance on conscientiousness, the importance of doing what is right and correct, regardless of the consequences, and not giving concern to expediency, and which tie in well with the moral and the ethical teachings of Scripture, emphasizing the necessity to do what is right in God's eyes and not that which comes natural to ourselves. And in many rural communities in Africa, tribal affiliations and living in tribes is still a vivid part of their history, and they understand better than some the accounts of the Israelites wandering through the wilderness, being separated from their land and separated from family. While these similarities may not be sufficient to declare these two cultures identical, the cultural similarities no doubt help to enhance their understanding of Scripture, and they nonetheless help bring to life the teachings and that to span the distance between the ages of these cultures and the ancient teachings. I recently was sitting and talking with an Italian man who immigrated to the United States, and he was sharing with me his understanding of the Lord's Prayer, and he told me that for him personally, the Lord's Prayer always made sense. He said, as soon as I read the opening lines of it, "Give us this day our daily bread," he said it made sense and it fit in well with what I understood. Because he said, in my community, in my culture, every morning the first person to wake up had the responsibility of going to the local bakery and purchasing fresh bread for the day for the entire family. He said, I never had to have somebody explain to me what it meant to have daily bread. He said, I grew up understanding that we bought what we needed to survive each day, and whoever got up first was responsible for taking care of it. This is only a small example of how culture affects our understanding of Scripture. Here in North America, this concept doesn't fit well, and it seems quite distant to our Sam's Clubs and our Costco mentality, where we buy months and months of supplies at once, and where the concept of daily bread has to be compared to other examples to help us understand what it means to have what we need for the only this day. This simple story is a perfect example of how cultural similarities ease the biblical understanding for many in the global South. Lastly, a significant reason why Christianity is beginning to see massive growth in the global South is because an opportunity for evangelism. For many years, the global South has been treated as unchurched nations. They have been evangelized, and with very varying efficacy, for centuries we have sent missionaries and missionary teams there. But now in many countries we see that the largest churches, the fastest growing movements, are not those led by foreign missionaries, but are in fact those led by national leaders. You could say that centuries and centuries of missiological efforts in these countries are finally taking root and bearing fruit in a massive way. As new leaders emerge in these native churches, they explore new and many times more effective methods of communicating the gospel message to their fellow compatriots. The gospel no longer becomes a foreign religion taught by foreigners living amongst them with stretched analogies or surface-level comparisons, but they new national leaders are able to delve deeper into the deepest parts of culture and the deepest parts of Scripture to teach it in a way that is culturally relevant. As the church becomes more and more nationalized by native teachers, it becomes increasingly relevant to the needs of those in the community. And as such, it grows and it spreads with greater facility and welcomes in new converts with a natural ease that comes from finding yourself feeling at home amongst people who share a similar life experience. I by no means intend to discount mission work, as I myself have dedicated much of my adult life to it, but rather I hope to emphasize that after the seeds have been planted, the soil tilled, the crops watered, what we are now seeing in many southern nations are the plants beginning to sprout, and Christianity is beginning to grow in the South, and new leaders are taking responsibility for the teaching and sharing of the gospel in those cultures in new and creative ways that we have never seen or prepared. So in light of this information, the rapid and the expansive growth of the church in the South paired with the waning influence of the church here in the North, the question then becomes, what are the implications for the future of the global church? Last year, before the Catholic Church elected Pope Francis, I was reading an interesting article titled, Why the Next Pope Should Come from the Global South. Now keep in mind, this article was written before the election of Pope Francis, but in it, Wesley Cranberg Michelson argues that in light of the massive growth of the Global South, it only makes sense that the new pope should also come from the Global South. Here are some statistics that he gives in relating in this article. He said that in the year 1900, two-thirds of all Catholics lived in Europe and North America, and a vast majority of the cardinals came from those two areas. Today, more than two-thirds of Catholics live in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. More than two-thirds of Catholics live in these three regions in the Global South, yet 64 of the cardinals come from Europe, 14 of the cardinals are from America, and the rest, less than a third, are from Asia, Africa, and Latin America. Cranberg Michelson argued that because the majority of Catholics live in the Global South, but they are so greatly underrepresented amongst the cardinals, it only makes sense that they deserve to have a leader of their faith who can represent them and who can relate to their lives and their struggles. And as you all know, I'm sure Pope Francis was elected last year as Pope of the Catholic Church and as the first pope to ever come from South America. But the problem presented in this article doesn't pertain only to the Catholic Church. It is, in fact, a very real problem for the global Christian church. For centuries, Europe has dominated the academic and the theological study of Scripture. In more recent times, the United States has gained great influence in this realm. But combined, these two regions have long dominated the church's understanding of Scripture and the biblical texts. So the question then becomes, what happens when Christians in the Global South outnumber their counterparts in the Global North, as has already happened? Will the minority continue to dominate the teaching and the understanding and interpretation of Scripture, or will our study of Scripture be allowed to be opened to a broader worldview, leaving our Western sphere of influence and mingling with these other cultures, which, as we have already said, in some ways bear greater similarities to the origins of Christianity than our own? Without a doubt, as the sacred texts are examined by new cultures and applied within these new contexts, new applications and teachings of Scripture will emerge. Many will no doubt find new themes, new ideas in Scripture which have previously been neglected. I'm reminded of a small Bible study that I led in Brazil one night, teachings on the study, teaching on the parable of the prodigal son. After reading the text, after having some discussion, I asked the question, how do you suppose that the older brother felt in staying and working for years while the younger brother went off and wasted his inheritance only to return and be greeted with a party? A very common question, I would assume, that's asked about the story of the prodigal son, a question that in some ways was, in my opinion, a throwaway question. But I was surprised when somebody quickly came to the defense of the prodigal son and condemned the older brother. Her argument was that the older brother was only upset and offended because he didn't have the courage nor the foresight to ask the father for his inheritance before his brother did. That the younger brother should be rewarded because he was bold, and he asked with confidence that he would receive something from his father, knowing that his father would provide it for him. And although he made mistakes with how he handled the money, we should have the same courage and the same faith as the younger brother to ask God for what we need and have confidence that when we fail, he will welcome us back. Now I'll confess that in all of my years of theological training and study, I've never once heard that application of this story made. And I'll also confess that as she was speaking and I was listening, I thought, nobody in here is going to buy into this, and so I'll find a way to quickly dismiss it and we'll move on. And to my surprise, everybody in the room related to it, and we had a great discussion at great lengths about this application of the story. And at the end of the study, many agreed very fervently with her that the story was, in fact, about us being like the younger brother and having the faith to ask God what we need and not being like the older brother, weak and afraid to do what we know we should be doing. It's a prime example of how a commonly taught and examined Scripture, when exposed to a new culture, finds new interpretations as it comes in contact with different values and different priorities. As this will undoubtedly be the case in all of these cultures, an important question now is how will the Northern Church respond to these emerging ideas and interpretations? Will we engage them? Will we discuss them? Will we admit that by no means do we have we completely figured out the Bible in all of its possible interpretations? Will we seek to find a fuller, a richer, and an ultimately more biblical interpretation and understanding of Scripture? If Christianity is truly to become a global religion, then it must welcome the participation of all global participants. As these new themes emerge, Western churches must learn to sincerely examine and engage these new ideologies. Because of the cultural and geographical similarities previously discussed, Southern Christians approach Scripture from a wholly different perspective. As they examine the Scriptures, new conclusions and theories are likely to emerge that may have been wholly overlooked, and it will be necessary for the Church to examine the validity of these new views and their potential benefits for the global Church. It is likely that the Southern Christians will draw different conclusions when examining Scripture than their Northern counterparts. Rather than shy away from this, these emerging theologies, and immediately dismiss them as errant, we, as Northern leaders, should examine the validity of these emerging theologies. These believers who approach the biblical text with a wholly new perspective may, in fact, discover hidden gems that have failed to be excavated by those who are so distant from the ancient cultures. These theologies could very well breathe a breath of new life into our theology and into the theological marketplace. At best, they may lead us to a better and a fuller understanding of Scripture. At worst, they may force us to engage in debate and to reconsider our old preconceived ideas and to re-engage with topics which we ourselves have long considered settled. Christianity in the global South is growing rapidly, and it's already numerically larger than the global North, which has long been the de facto seat of Christianity. As future generations look back upon this time in church history, it may be, in fact, the dawn of a new age in Christianity, a true global expansion in which Christianity severs its long-planted roots in Western Asia, Western Europe, and North America, and spreads throughout the world, becoming a truly multi-centric faith. Contrarily, years from now, the world Christian population may look back with regret, lamenting how the Western world failed to include and engage these emerging communities and bemoaning the countless opportunities lost in these emerging Christian cultures. Fortunately, the influence of the Northern Church on the global stage is not yet dead, and how it responds to these recent developments may bear heavily on the future of the global church. By actively engaging these new ideologies in rigorous debate and incorporating them into a sound theology, the church may gain greater insights into our most sacred text. It is through this engagement with Scripture and through our engagement with our brothers and sisters around the world that Christianity will thrive as a global religion. As we embrace the global future of the church and as we celebrate how God is moving in the world. Thank you for coming this morning. If you have any questions, I would be glad to take a couple minutes to address those.
Could you repeat the whole lesson? Sorry.
Let's start over at page one.
How do you think, Zane, as we are still raising up teams to go and do mission work, Great Cities is still raising teams to do mission work, MRN and other organizations, our schools are still raising up teams to go to the mission field. How should we prepare those church planting teams, mission teams from North America, given some of the new realities in the global South? I mean, they're going to places where the church is, in fact, in many places, growing. It's already planted. So what would their role be if you could speak to a whole generation of new missionaries preparing to go in the next 10 years from North America, North Americans, you know, mostly, you know, white males like yourself and your wife, of course, she's not a male, but, you know, white missionaries going to the global South, whether it's Asia, Africa, or Latin America. Is there a posture, is there an attitude that you would encourage them to embrace that's maybe different from 100 years ago?
Okay. That's a great question. I think, as I said about speaking in Brazil and giving examples from South America, I can only speak from my own experience. I think that maybe something that took us, I wouldn't say off guard, but maybe it was a little surprising, and maybe something that future missionaries should consider, is that I think we've all heard stories of great missionaries going into the Amazon or going into Africa and going into these tribes of people who are in some ways uneducated, in other ways have no concept, if they are educated, have no concept of Christianity or the Bible, those type of things. And so I think we've all grown up with those stories. We've all heard those stories. And I think if we're honest as missionaries, sometimes we have that vision of ourselves. We think of ourselves as these pioneers going into a land where nobody has ever heard of Jesus, and we're taking this message. I think something that surprised us is our team in Niteroi was the first team to do a Church of Christ church plant there in Niteroi. But we were surprised by the Christians that we found there in Niteroi who weren't denominationally Church of Christ, but who had sat down for themselves, had studied Scripture, and had come to pretty much, in some cases, the exact same conclusions that we as a church and we as missionaries would have. And so I think maybe if I could reconsider my approach to mission work going into it, was to just be aware that in a lot of places, Christianity has already been taught. Now, I'm not saying there's no need for missionaries or for missions work, but I think having a concept of that we would be engaging not just with people who had no idea of Christianity, but people who had already been taught, in some ways agreed with us, in others, you know, people had been taught ideologies and theologies that were way removed from Scripture. And so just knowing in advance that we would be encountering much more of that than we would people who had no idea what Christianity was. And so I think that is going to become an important part for missionaries as they go into the world, knowing that they're encountering people who already have preconceived ideas of what Christianity is in many regions, and being prepared to address those, and not just going in with the naivety of thinking that we're going in and nobody's going to know anything about the Bible, and we're gonna teach them from scratch.
Kind of like Paul going to Ephesus and finding these 12 disciples of John the Baptist who shared much of his theology.
Yeah,
I'm gonna call it that.
Yeah, and I think continuing that idea. I mean, what we found in Brazil was a lot of people who had some sort of biblical history may have had theologies that were different than us, but they weren't afraid to engage in discussions and to re-examine those theologies. And I think, at least here in the U.S., I've seen that if you meet someone who's a Christian of a certain denomination and you're of another, or they have different beliefs, there's really no debate that can go on that will change minds. But in Brazil, that wasn't the case. We could very easily engage with people, have biblical studies with them, show them some passages, and a lot of people responded really positively to that. So I would say that's also important to keep in mind, that if in an initial phase we don't see eye to eye on something, a lot of times in the Global South, it's worth continuing a relationship and a study to pursue that.
Well, just to expand on that, why do you think that is on the mission field? They're more receptive to embracing other Christians, which is here.
I'll give two responses. One, I think this is something I experienced early on before I went to Brazil. I went on a 6-week mission trip to Northern Ireland, and while I was in Northern Ireland, we were out pamphleting in this square, and this girl came up to us and she said, "Are you guys Christians?" I'm not going to do my Irish accent for you. She said, "Are you guys Christians?" And I said, "Yes." And she just gave us a big hug. And she said, "I'm so glad to see another Christian." She said, I never see anybody out here doing any type of evangelism or biblical work. And she was like, "It's so great that you guys are you know, out here doing this." Now, I tell that story not to brag about anything that we were doing. I mean, we were just handing out pamphlets. We weren't even engaging people in conversation. There's a whole other story on effectiveness of evangelism there. But the point was that I have no idea to this day anything about her history as a Christian. She has no idea of my history as a Christian. But just the fact that she lived in a culture that had so few Christians around, that seeing another Christian was something that she was willing to engage and talk with. And I think in the North, we're surrounded by Christians to the extent that seeing another Christian, seeing a, I'll call them pagans, an atheist, someone who's not a Christian, is a lot rarer than seeing a Christian. So in the first response, I think that people are more easily engaging other Christians in the mission field because there are so few Christians around. As I said, 25% of the population in the global south as Christians. So seeing another Christian, regardless of denomination, regardless of their theological beliefs, is something worth celebrating for many of them. The other part of that response that I would give, and this is specific to Brazil, so it may or may not apply. In fact, I would assume it doesn't apply to a lot of other cultures, specifically probably Asian cultures. But Brazilians are very open to the idea of exploring new spiritual things, and you can hold multiple religious beliefs that in a lot of ways disagree with each other, but you can hold them simultaneously in your mind and kind of pull from which ones you need at the moment. And so I think in that sense, we've studied with spiritists who don't believe in scripture at all, but believe in the communicating directly with the spiritual realm and that kind of thing. We've studied with other Christians. We've studied with Catholics. We've studied with atheists who confess that they don't believe in religion at all. They don't believe in God at all. But for some reason, they're willing to sit down and to study scripture and talk about it. And so specific to Brazil, maybe other Latin American cultures, Brazilians are a lot more comfortable with ambiguity than Americans are. And so they're okay being a spiritist and sitting down studying the Bible. They're okay being a Catholic and walking into what they call evangelical churches and sitting down and studying the Bible with someone that they know won't agree, but they're okay doing that. And so specific to Brazil, I think that's one reason that they can engage in those conversations.
This paternalistic north attitude we need to really work with. We're used to doing two and four, and we need to learn how to work alongside of,
right? Yeah.
In terms of, our whole mentality of preparation and going.
Yeah, and I think our time's coming to an end, but I'll say I've met Brazilians who brag to me about the fact that their church, their Brazilian church, has sent missionaries to Orlando and to Houston and to Dallas. So Brazilians, in a lot of ways, are beginning to see North America as a mission field and as a place where they will send people to work. And so I think that's a trend that we're probably likely to see if the Northern Church continues to decline and the South continues to grow as it has, that who knows in 20 or 30 years if North America and Europe don't become a major mission field for Africa, Asia, and Latin America.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it very much. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon down in the field house. In just a few moments, we'll begin singing and